All right, we are ready for John chapter 4 as we make our way through our survey of the New Testament. So we'll get underway. This is our outline on the book of John from J. Sidlow Baxter. We're still in the first section and will be for a little while. But we finished the first subsection this morning in chapter 4. And so we're dealing with that public ministry to the Jews. And then we'll see his ministry to his own. So John is arranged a little differently than the other Gospels, meaning the other Gospels often have started off with the Galilean ministry. Then we have his later Judean ministry. But this one is somewhat different, and you can see that quite obviously. To review where we've been, we've only been through three chapters. Chapter 1 was, He is the True Light. Chapter 2, the power and authority of Christ. And then chapter 3, Nicodemus said this, Teacher, have come from God. All right, let's go to chapter 4 and answer to question 1. What is chapter 4 about? Well, it's about the testimony to the Samaritans and the Galileans. And thus we have 2 points to the chapter. The first 42 verses is the testimony to the Samaritans. And then 43 to 54 is the testimony to the Galileans. And so the message of who he was, he is that true light, went to the Samaritans. It goes to the Galileans, and we see how they reacted to that. So this is what John 4 is about. Let's go to question 2. The question was, where were the Samaritans? That really should have been, who were the Samaritans? So where were they? They were from Samaria. Where was Samaria? Just north of Judah. And so, and just south of Galilee. So it was a region, if you went one to the other, you either had to bypass or go through. We'll see more about that here in just a moment. So who were they? Who were the Samaritans? Mixed group of people. Good answer. They were mixed breeds. They were a mixed race of people. More about that here in just a moment. We'll get to that here in a second. All right, let's talk about the first 26 verses here. Jesus gives testimony to the Samaritan woman. Now, we don't see her at first, but let's make our way through the text. You remember in chapter 2, John was baptizing, and Jesus was baptizing, and there was a little disturbance from the standpoint Jesus is baptizing, and some thought maybe that this was a rival to John. And John made that clear, he's not my rival at all. But when the Lord knew, verse 1, that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus had made and baptized more disciples than John, thus the confusion earlier in chapter 3, and then parentheses at verse 2 says, though Jesus himself did not baptize, but his disciples. In other words, it was credited that Jesus was baptizing, but he's doing the teaching and they're actually doing the immersion. They're taking them and putting them under the water. But that was the report. So he left Judea and departed again to Galilee. So he's headed to Galilee. We'll say more about that, where that region is, in just a moment. Now verse 4 is quite interesting. Typically, the Jews, because of a conflict we'll talk about, would bypass and skirt around Samaria. Let me get ahead of ourselves to look at the end of verse 9. At the end of verse 9, for the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Didn't get along too well. Why? We'll get to that in a moment. But the text says that he needed to go through Samaria. We're not told why. Some have suggested that might have been for some personal need, that there may have been something else. It's not mentioned in the text. He needed to go through that region, and while through there, he does some teaching. Maybe that's the case. More likely that it was to fulfill his ministry, to carry the message there, that he needed to go there. I like what Joseph Casimir said when he was here in a sermon, in a meeting. He said he came to this text and said he needed to go through Samaria. Why? Because he cared. I like the way he put that. He cared. He went through because he cared about the people, and he carries the message there to them. Now, verse 5, where did he go when he got there? Came to a city, Sychar, And this was a plot of ground where that Jacob had given his son. Where is Sychar? Well, let's put it on the map if I can get my remote to work. It's froze up. I can't even point. I can point right here. Right here, about under that, between that A and that I and that A is where that is supposed to be, but we'll get that going and put that back on the map here in just a moment. But that's Sychar. Let's give a few references here now with reference to the story behind this ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob had bought this plot of ground in Genesis 33 and in verse 19. I'm not going to take the time to, there we go, right there. He bought this plot of ground, Genesis 38. Genesis 48 in verse 22, he gave it to Joseph, gave a portion of the ground that he had purchased to Joseph. That is mentioned again in Joshua chapter 24 and in verse 32. So at least three references that we need to tie with that. So this was where Jacob's well was. We'll talk about the significance of that well in just a moment. And this was at the foot of Mount Gerizim, which is going to be mentioned here in our text in just a moment. All right. Now, verse 6 says, well, let's go back to verse 5. Verse 6, that Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well, and it was about the sixth hour. Some have pointed out that John tries to thread, though his focus is on the deity, where Mark and Luke talk about him being the Son of Man more, that John's focus is on his deity. He threads in that the humanity of Christ, that he was tired, he was journeying, and he got tired and he had to settle on the well for resting. And he's going to make other references to that all along. But notice about the sixth hour, that's about noon. If Jewish time is being considered, and I think it is, some think it's later than that it was Roman time. I think it's Jewish time. Be that as it may, if that be the case, custom was, this was not the customary time for women to come out to the well. And she's coming at a different time. Other women are not there, apparently, because Jesus sits by the well and he sees this woman come up, not a crowd of women. Nothing is mentioned about a crowd of women. Why did she do that? Well, we don't know exactly. But some suggest because of her moral character, mentioned later beginning about verse 15, that she may have been viewed as an outcast. And thus she's coming when there would not be other people there. Maybe that's the case. It may have been there was an urgent need, and therefore she had to come at that hour when that was not the typical time for them to come. All right. Now, let's talk about who these Samaritans were before we go any further. Before the Assyrians took over and the Syrians rose in power, you remember in Old Testament history we have the Syrian nation grew in power to become a world dominant power. Before that, this region where they controlled was the area of Ephraim and Manasseh. During that Assyrian captivity, which started 722 BC, the Israelites were deported, many of them, not all of them, but that's how captivity took place. They would take some of the better people and take them off into captivity and use them and leave a remnant of the people there, and then they would bring foreigners in. And so bringing foreigners in, that left those that were there to mix with those foreigners, those Gentiles came in, and so the Samaritans ended up being a mixed race. And so they had some Jewish background, and then they had the Gentile background, and that led to much idolatrous worship. And they did do that. They had a lot of idolatry as well as in other places. So why was there friction? Let's get ahead of ourselves to the end of verse 9. We hadn't got there, but the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Well, they often disowned the Jews when they had trouble, according to Josephus, the Jewish historian. You remember in Ezra 4, there were some that offered to help. Remember that help that was offered in building the wall and building the rebuilding in that post-exile period? There's some from Samaria. And so that was viewed as rebellion and some interference. And Ezra had encouraged separation from those marriages with those people that had taken place. in the post-exile period. This is part of where they got those women. It was right here in Samaria. And so because of all of that, there's friction between the two. And so here is the purebred Jew looking at the mixed bread in Samaria to have nothing to do with them. Does that make sense? Whether that was right, whether that's wrong, whether that's immaterial, the Jews and the Samaritans just didn't get along, generally. And so you'd skirt around and not go through that region. Questions or comments on who they were? Let's go to verse 7. So he sees this woman coming, a woman of Samaria. We don't know anything about her yet. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." What's so strange about that? There's two things. Yes, she's a woman. The rabbis among the Jews, I've read, how far it was practiced, I'm not sure, but some of the rabbis had ruled out talking to a woman, even your wife, in public. There's to be no man talking to a woman. And so this was a political no-no for you to be out in public talking to a woman, number one, and besides that, she's not a Jew. She's a Samaritan. And so that's another no-no. And so he turns to her and says, "Give me a drink," because she's come to get water from the well. The disciples aren't there. Where have they gone? They went off to buy food. And so she asked, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me a drink from a Samaritan woman? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. We just don't get along. And how would you do that? Why would you do that?" All right. Now that brings us to verse 9. Let's start at verse 10. What does Jesus now introduce to her? He uses the occasion. We're going to make a point about soul winning, about reaching out to try to save souls. And this is a great text. Learn several lessons. What does he do here? He uses the circumstance, which was there's a need for water. There's drawing water. There is water that you need, to draw some parallel about spiritual things. And so he says to her, verse 10, "If you had known the gift of God," I take that to refer to salvation, redemption, "that if you had known the gift of God," if you understood about salvation, the need for salvation, your need for salvation, how it could come to you, is that making sense? If you understood that, and there's a second thing, if you'd understood what? Who I am, who it is that talks with you and asks you for a drink. If you had understood those two things, you would have asked him, that is, you would have asked me, and he would have given you living water. Well, that's a strange thing to her. What is this living water? And so she says, what? Verse 11. You don't have a water pot. You don't have any. In other words, Jesus has come without a water pot. He's come to the well. She came with a water pot that she left. We'll get to that in a moment. And you don't have a water pot. You don't have anything to draw with. And where are you going to get this living water? And the well is deep. The well was said to be, I forgot the dimensions across. I think it was 7 foot across, but 80 to 90 foot deep. Pretty deep well. In other words, how in the world are you going to get water? This well, Jacob's well, is 90 foot deep, 80 to 90 foot deep. Where are you going to get living water? And then she says, verse 12, she don't know what she's asking. What's the question? Are you greater than Jacob? In other words, there's no way you're greater than Jacob. Oh, yeah, he was. He was there before Jacob, but she doesn't know that. Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and he drank from it, and his sons? And that Jesus' answer to her was, if you drink of this water, you'll never thirst again. Whoever drinks of the water that I give you, if you drink of this water from the well, you'll thirst again. You drink of the water that I give you, you'll never thirst, but the water that I give will become a fountain springing into everlasting life. So notice what Jesus had just said. I am the source of the living water. He's talked about salvation. I can give you this water, you'll never thirst again. And if you drink of it, it ends up in the result not only of salvation now, but everlasting life. I'm talking about eternal life here. Coming through this, that's why he calls it the living water. All right, any questions down through verse 14? She doesn't understand the nature of living water, does she? Questions or comments? Yeah, it takes time to process, and so she's not going to get everything clearly at first. She doesn't. There's much that she's going to understand. Even when she leaves and goes, she doesn't have a full understanding of who he is, but she has some understanding. In fact, she's still raising questions when she gets over in Samaria. And so that's a good point. She's going to go with what she knows, what she's familiar with. She's not grasping and understanding, but Jesus is making a point about living water. Now let's go to 15 to 18. He explains the need for the living water. There's two things he accomplishes here. Did I have a question on that? Yes, question number four. Let's go to question number four. What did Jesus, asking the woman about her husband, accomplish? And ask, can you think of two things? There were two things he accomplished when he asked her about her husband. What was it? All right, that's a good point. And the power that he had. Yes, two things then. Her need for the living water. In other words, if she has salvation and she is, her ticket is punched for eternal life, she don't need this living water, does she? There's a need for you to have this living water. And let me remind you what your need is. Number one. Number two, by his knowledge of her past, without her ever telling him that, tells of his power and of his deity. So he just revealed two things. You have a need, and I'm the source of your answer. Does that make sense? He accomplished two things in that. Here's your need. I'm the source of your answer. So let's look at him explaining the need for living water. He said to the woman, or the woman said to the servant, to him, "Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst nor come here again." She's still thinking of literal water. So I want some of this water so I don't have to keep coming back and trudging and bringing this water pot and carrying it back home, and I don't want to do that. Give me the water so I can drink of it and I don't need any more water. So he said, "You go call your husband and come here. Go get him and bring him." And what was her answer? "I have no husband." And he said, "You're right. You don't have a husband. In fact, you have had five." Not that you've had some. You've had five, the exact number. You've had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What's the circumstance? Well, commentators have varied a little bit, not a lot, but some, on that. Some think that she was married to this last guy and it wasn't a scriptural or legitimate marriage, and so therefore Jesus said he's not your legitimate husband. I take it that she's living with a man without the honor of marriage. Either way, it would be adultery, so it didn't make a lot of difference. But you've had five husbands. I'll tell you about your past. You've had five husbands and the one you're with now is not your husband. She didn't deny that. She didn't say, "Oh yeah, it's fine. And I haven't had five husbands." She didn't deny that. She agreed, "I have had five husbands, and I'm living with one now that's not my husband." She's an immoral woman. No wonder. She come from a group of people that had little use for morals. All right. Notice at verse 5, "For you have five husbands, and one of you now is not your husband, in that you spoke truly." In other words, he said, "You spoke the truth when you said you don't have a husband." Now, we're getting into the next section, but her response to that was, "You've got some knowledge somehow from God. There's a connection with God somewhere." That's what she's saying. "I perceive that you are a prophet." In other words, you have a relationship with God. "You knew that, and I didn't tell you that. Something different about you." All right. Let's go further. Let's talk about this discussion about worship. Now, this gets interesting to me. at verse 19. She said, I perceive that you are a prophet. And she immediately shifts gears for one of two reasons. Exactly why, I don't know. I think I have a good idea. She said, our fathers worshipped on this mountain. That is, we're right here at Mount Gerizim. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. Now, either one of two things. One, some may think or seem to think that you're a prophet, and now that I know that you are a prophet and I perceive that you're a prophet, let's talk about this question I've wondered about. I don't take that really the case. That may have been the case. I think she's shifting gears. She feels uncomfortable talking about her marriage in the past and the man she's living with now. And as King observes in his work, he said that's quite often in talking to people about their sin, they divert and go to another subject. I want to ask you about this over here. And she seems to do that. She diverts a little attention. Well, you can figure that out for yourself. I'm just posing that for what it's worth. And let's go ahead, and then we'll talk about this controversy over the place of worship. Verse 21, Jesus said, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem, I misread that, left a word out. Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. Now let's talk about that controversy that's going on here in this discussion. The Samaritans thought Mount Gerizim was the place of worship. Where is Mount Gerizim? Here we are at Sychar. This is where we were a minute ago. Mount Gerizim is right where they're right at the foot of Mount Gerizim. Shechem is right here. This is all right in the same region. And their reason for it was tradition. Many of them thought that Adam was made from it. Some thought the ark rested there. Others thought Jacob, this was the place where Jacob had wrestled with an angel. More in harmony with those who tried to use Deuteronomy, King develops this in his work on John, that that Deuteronomy 12 does not name Jerusalem specifically, but Mount Gerizim was alluded to before that. So they argued, that is, the Samaritans argued, that Mount Gerizim is the right place of worship and Jerusalem was never named. However, the reason for the Jews thinking Jerusalem was the place was by divine revelation. God said he'd choose a place. Deuteronomy 12, 1 Kings chapter 9. And so here was the controversy. Is Jerusalem the place? Mount Gerizim? The Jews and the Samaritans argued back and forth. And Jesus says this. Let's get what he says here. He said, the time is coming when neither on this mountain, that is Mount Gerizim, or in Jerusalem, you'll worship the Father. In other words, the time is coming when his kingdom is in place. What's he saying? It's not going to matter where you worship, Jerusalem, Mount Gerizim, or anywhere else. For he said, you worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. Now, verse 22 is a difficult verse. Maybe it's not for you, it is for me. I think he's saying, I'm standing on the Hebrew canon, that is the Hebrew text. The Samaritans rejected everything but the Pentateuch. And Jesus is accepting the complete Old Testament canon. Does that make sense? You don't know, you don't understand what you're saying, and your religion is out of kelter with the revelation of God, and the Jews worshiping at Jerusalem was in harmony with the revelation of God. Now, what you notice, two things Jesus did. He's trying to reach this woman, and he hits hard on a doctrinal difference, doesn't he? He runs the risk, as one writer said, of making her mad, making her run off. But he still hit hard, didn't he? More about that in a moment. Then he shifts gears at verse 23. What else does he say? Bottom of the slide may help you a little bit. Time is coming when my kingdom is in place. That's what he's referring to. It's not going to matter where, but it will matter how. God is a spirit, and those that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Now, I'll come back to that, but let's go ahead and finish that section. And the woman said, when she heard all of that discussion, what was her reaction? She'd already said, you seem to be a prophet. And now she says, Something about all of this discussion made her think about the Messiah coming. I know the Messiah is coming and he will tell us all things. And she's wondering, he's telling me all things. Could this be? And Jesus said, I that speak unto you am he. He just made the claim, I am the Messiah. I am the prophesied one. All right, let's go back to verse 24 just for a moment. I ask a question on this. What does it mean to worship God in spirit and in truth? Some suggest, some commentators among brethren suggest, and they may be right, that what Jesus is focusing on is spirit and in truth is just both phrases refer to just spiritual worship. It's not the place. It's not that you have to travel to a place to worship, like in Jerusalem, and worship is not acceptable in another place, but it's a spiritual. I take in truth because the Samaritans' worship was not in truth. They did not take the complete revelation of God. Does that make sense? So in truth is means simply every act has to be authorized. We do all that God commands, nothing more, nothing less. But in spirit is from the heart. And how do you know? Well, let me show you a parallel. Let's go to Romans chapter 2. See if this doesn't make sense to you. Romans 2, 28 and 29. I'm looking for a definition of in the spirit. What does that mean? Verse 28, he is not a Jew which is one outwardly, nor the circumcision outward of the flesh. In other words, just the outward motion is not what makes one a true Jew. He is a Jew who is one inwardly, and the circumcision that is of the heart in the spirit. See the spirit? What does spirit mean? From the heart. In other words, not just going through the motion. I'm singing a song, but I didn't think about I'm going through the prayer, the words of the prayer, but I didn't think. I'm partaking of the elements of the Lord's Supper, but I'm not focused. I could be doing things in truth, but not from in spirit. Does that make sense? One's easy, the other one's hard. It's easy to sing a song from memory. It's another thing to focus. Make sense? So it's not going to matter where, it's going to matter how. Let's go to 27 to 20, 29 and 30. What happens here? They come back. They've been off to get something to eat, and they are marveling. Why are they marveling? That he's talking to a woman. Any woman, much less Samaritan woman. But they didn't say anything. He's the master. And the woman left her water pot. That's an interesting point. Wouldn't that be an important thing? You went to the well with a water pot? She left that. Tells me something of the urgency. I remember preaching one time on hell, and a guy who had been coming out during the meeting every night just with encouraging words, asking questions. As soon as amen was said, he had this mad look on his face, and I mean, he blew past me and busted that back door open, and he was gone. Well, what on earth? What's going on with him? The lesson on hell disturbed him so, thinking about his brother that was lost, he took off to his house, spent all night talking to him, and baptized him the next day after spending all night studying about, I'm afraid he's going to hell and I want to make sure I save his soul. This woman is kind of like that. I ain't got time for anything else. I'm going to leave my water pot, and she takes off. And where does she go? She goes to Samaria, goes into the city, and says, come see a man who told me all things. Could this be the Christ? She's still pondering that, isn't she? And they went out of the city and came to him. All right? So she takes the testimony and goes to the Samaritans. Now let's quickly work through 31 to 38. There's a little difficulty when we get to verse 38, but we'll get to that. Work through it. Jesus is the spiritual food. Our doing the will of God is the spiritual food. So the disciples come back and they ask to tell him, eat, Rabbi. In other words, they have food. And he said, I have food that you don't know about. And they were wondering, they're like the Samaritan woman. They're wondering, where'd you get it? Who brought him food? We went to buy food, and what's going on here? So now notice at verse 34. At verse 34, Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. This is what the food I'm talking about. That I have food that you don't know about. You're focused on food. This woman is focused on water. I'm focused on doing the will of God. That's the food I'm talking about. I have food that you don't know about, doing the will of the Father. And then verse 35 to 38, let me summarize what that's about, and then we'll come back and look at verse 38. I think Jesus is saying here that you can say things like, you can look at the harvest or the fields and say, you know, it's 4 months to harvest. And then you go and you reap. But that's not the way it is spiritually. He said, it's now. You just look around and the harvest is available now. Look at this woman. Look at the Samaritans. We're going into Galilee. The Samaritans are coming out to us, which the disciples don't know, but Jesus would have known. So notice at verse 37, he talks about sowing and reaping. And this saying is true. This is not a quotation from the Old Testament that we can determine. Some think there is an Old Testament reference, but it doesn't seem to match. That one sows and another reaps. And apparently that's a saying. It may have been a prophet that had said that. That might have been an inspired phrase, but it's just not recorded that we know of. And so Jesus makes use of that and said, I sent you out to reap for that which you have not labored, and others have labored, and you have entered into their labors. What's he talking about? Some think he's talking about the work that John the Baptist did, the preparatory work. We're going to reap that. You're going to reap from that preparatory work. I think more likely in the context, it refers to the work of the Samaritan woman. She's gone into Samaria, and the Samaritans are about to come out to us. The disciples don't know that yet. We're about to see that in the next section. Does that make sense? She's done some sowing over there. She's gone over there and told them what I've done. And they're coming out to see what's going on. So let's see what happens, beginning at verse 39. When they got there, what happened? Some of them accepted based on what she said, the testimony of the woman. And others came out and they urged him to stay, and they believed because of his own words, and they went to the woman and said, we now... we've seen it for ourselves, and we believe. So how was he accepted in Samaria? Well, Jesus is about to make a statement a little later. A prophet is without honor in his own country. And the further he gets away from Jerusalem and Bethlehem, the more receptive they seem to be. And thus the Galilean ministry that we'll talk about here in a moment. All right, let's go to 43 to 54. So the testimony to the Samaritans, the woman was an excellent object of teaching. And then here we have the Galileans. Now, there's two things that happen here. The Galileans received Christ, and then there was a miracle done as a sign. So let's work through verse 44 and 46, particularly. Verse 44. He departed for Galilee, which is just north of Samaria. He's been to Galilee before. And he said, a prophet has no honor in his own country. I think there's two applications of that. One is the further away he gets from Jerusalem, Bethlehem area, he's rejected in Judea. In his early Judean ministry, they didn't accept him well. So he goes off, and further he goes, the more receptive they are. That's true. But it's also true, Luke 4, which is not mentioned here, but in Luke 4, he went to Nazareth, and he wasn't received very well, was he? So that's where he was raised. Born in Bethlehem, but raised in Nazareth, which is in Galilee. And so when he goes to Cana, he bypasses Nazareth. So it seems to be two applications. I'm getting away from Judah, and I'm being received more, but I bypass Nazareth, and I'm also received up here in Cana. But be that as it may, they received him when they saw the things that he'd done, because they had seen some stuff in Jerusalem, because they'd been down to the feast. That's what Jesus was doing there in that early Judean ministry. Beginning at verse 46 to 54, there is a nobleman. He seems to be of the king's court. Some have suggested he's royalty. No indication that he's royalty. Just he seems to be one that was a part of King Herod's court, ruled in his court, etc. He was from Capernaum, and he came to Cana. The way the crow flies, that's about 15, 16 miles. Depending on how you journey, that could be as up to 25, 26, 27 miles. So he'd come quite a ways. That's not by car, obviously. So he's come quite a ways to come to Jesus. And why does he come to Jesus? His son is near death, and he thinks Jesus can do something about it. And Jesus makes a point in verse 48, that unless you people see signs and wonders, you'll by no means believe. He's prompting deeper knowledge, deeper faith, deeper appreciation. And so he said, well, come before my son dies, my child dies. And what does Jesus say to him? Go. He's going home. Your son lives. See, that's a test of faith. Is he going to walk off or demand Jesus go with him? That's a test of faith. Jesus said, go, he lives. And so he took off home and took Jesus at his word. And when he got near, what happened? Servants come running out and said, he's doing well and he's alive and da-da-da-da-da. And that was about 5 o'clock p.m. according to verse 52. And he then asked, well, when did he get better? And it was about 5 yesterday. Well, that's exactly when I was talking to Jesus. And so he himself believed in his whole household. So here was the testimony in Galilee he was received. Making sense? Now, we've got about 2 minutes to go, and I wanted to jump over and see this right here. There's some lessons about soul winning from John 4. Soul winning can take place anywhere. A well wouldn't seem like the best place to have a study about someone's spiritual needs, would it? And yet Jesus engages a woman at a well. People are busy. They're coming to get water and leave. It could be done at any time. Noon, perhaps the prospect was busy at noon. And she's on a mission. I've got to have water for my household. And yet he still takes time to reach out to her. It could be done by anyone. The woman, or with anyone. This woman had been married before, in fact, 5 times, and now she's living with a man. Doesn't seem like a good prospect, does it? I mean, what are the chances of her turning to the Lord? Doesn't seem very good, does it? You can use the circumstance you're in as a parallel. In other words, Jesus used the water. On another occasion, he used food. Let's talk about food. You want to talk about food? All right. Let's talk about spiritual food. You don't want to talk about water? Let's talk about living water. You want to talk about a race? You're at a race? All right, let's talk about the race of life, the Christian race. See, there's all kinds of parallels you can use in the occasion of the circumstance you're in to make a spiritual application. Jesus did that. Soul winning is as easy as saying come. All she did was go out to Samaria and say, just come, come see him. Sometimes soul winning is just involves you inviting someone, hey, come, come to church with me. And then there's urgency. She left her water pot to go tell. She thought this was an important message. And so she left her water pot. Are we too busy with our water pots? We can't go tell. Or do we leave our water pots and go tell we have found the Christ? You've got to hear this. You got to know. You just got to know. Does that make sense? Questions or comments? Good point. Yeah. She apparently was an outcast, and so this would not be typically what an outcast would go do, but something about seeing Christ, if you didn't catch what JP just said, she was emboldened to go back running in and not tell the women. She went and told the men, you've got to come see this man. He told me all things ever I did. In other words, y'all know the kind of person I am. He knows all of that, and he's not from around here. We're done. Chapter 5 next time.